How does Jesus of the book of Revelation compare with the picture of Jesus as presented in the Gospels? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson from the Walla Walla University School of Theology, your host and study guide author. We continue our series on the preparation for the end time. My conversation partners are again Matilda Fry and Brent Berglund from the School of Theology at Walla Walla. Welcome. Now, let's take that leading question and simply say, how does Jesus of the book of Revelation compare with the picture of Jesus as presented in the Gospels? Now, the reason I raise that is that Jesus of the Gospels often is presented so very gentle, takes the children in his arms. On initial impulse, I don't think I see that in the book of Revelation.
Yeah, that's not the first picture you get.
Aren't we in a context in the Roman Empire where Christians are persecuted and where they hope to receive justice and to be vindicated and to be saved from their oppressors?
And I would argue as well, Alden, that perhaps when we say the Gospels, what we mean by that is usually the Synoptic Gospels. Because if I were to take John by himself and read it, the picture of Jesus that I get from John, Jesus is all snarky a bit. He seems impatient with those who ask questions. He fires back questions at those who seem on the surface to be asking very valid inquiries about things they may not understand, and Jesus' responses are maybe even harsh in John. The book of Revelation then goes maybe one step further, and there's multiple pictures of Jesus. We could spend days and days just on the pictures of Jesus, but he is far more transcendent. In Revelation, he is not the close, the one who touches and heals and shows his compassion. That doesn't seem to be the big picture in Revelation.
Okay. Now, Brent, you also raised a question about the study guide where I had, I think, departed from the straight and narrow way from your perspective. The revelation of Jesus Christ. Now, the genitive there raises all kinds of possibilities. So tell me your story.
I don't think you've strayed. You just gave one half of the picture. It says the revelation of Jesus Christ, and you suggested that the revelation came, it's given by Jesus. I would suggest that the revelation of Jesus, that word of, is pretty filled with meaning. It is not just a revelation given by Christ, although if you look at the train of communication in chapter 1, the first couple of verses, God to Jesus, Jesus to the angel, the angel to John, John to his servants, Jesus certainly gives the revelation, but this is an unveiling of who Jesus is. The book of Revelation is kind of answering that question for the disciples. Well, now that Jesus is gone, where is he? What's he doing? Recalling that phrase again in the Gospel of John, I go to prepare a place for you, that there's somehow that Jesus is dealing within the stream of history, within salvation history. He's doing things for his people. He's dealing with the sin problem. And at the end of the book, he brings in a full end. And like you said, Matilda, he vindicates his people, even though they have to wait a while. Jesus hasn't left them. He's still operating in the background, even if they feel abandoned. Even if they feel like they've been left.
Now, I'd like to press that question a bit more about the picture of Jesus in the book of Revelation. And you said that it's much more picks up on the Gospel of John, where you don't have gentle Jesus, meek and mild so much. I suppose, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head, do we tend to privilege the Sermon on the Mount when we think of Jesus? This is the Jesus who turns the other cheek, who goes the second mile. This is the one who says, love your enemies.
Who seeks to save the lost.
Yeah.
But that is still not an easygoing Jesus. Mm-hmm. Just imagine you do that in a real situation. That is a hard decision to make and then to follow through with it.
Yeah, going the second mile is by no means an easy way out.
Yes.
Pray for those who persecute you. If Jesus were to tell the those going through persecution under Rome, you need to pray for Rome, pray for Babylon, like the old Israelites were, pray for its success. They might have found that fairly abhorrent.
Yeah. Now, my question is, how does our residual picture of God, however and wherever that came from, How does that residual picture of God and of Jesus affect us when we seek to understand the book of Revelation? What I mean is, if you come with a tough picture of God, then that will see what you, that's going to be what you see in the book of Revelation.
I think the opposite could be said about someone like Martin Luther, who approached the book of Revelation and didn't see righteousness by faith and didn't see the gifted sacrifice of Christ presented as clearly as he wanted. And so he threw out the book of Revelation to some degree, saying, I don't find value in it, even though Jesus is the lamb slain from the foundation of the world in Revelation. And in chapter 5, he's the one slain for the redemption of humanity. But there's certainly more of the, perhaps if I can use the phrase, the Old Testament God, Alden, a specialty of your study, we see more of the God who wants to take care of the nations who are opposed to the covenant that he makes with his people. That seems to be more the picture, the plagues, the God who sends plagues.
Mm-hmm. You have the warrior God who comes to save and to, he destroys, and you have half or more, one third or of the world killed at, in different parts in the book of Revelation. Clearly you have allusions to different parts in the Old Testament. You do not have direct citations or the direct places in the Old Testament, but you have allusions to the stories of the plagues.
And they don't tend to be the places where God comes and says, you are my special chosen one. You are my child. I found you and bathed you. The pictures of in Isaiah of God coming to his people. You don't find the love language until the very end when there's a wedding. It doesn't mean that his church is abandoned, that God certainly has advice for his churches in chapters 2 and 3, but even that advice is fairly straightforward. If you don't repent, I'll remove your lampstand. You'll not be a light in the world. That seems fairly black and white to me.
But then that's why it is important to understand the context, why this book is written and to whom it was given in the first place, to people who were suffering, who were put in dungeons and prisons, and who expect of this God to be a strong, forceful God.
And that he would intervene
yes.
in their behalf.
Yes.
And they're really going through the experience of John the Baptist, perhaps in prison. Are you really still there, God? And what it says to me, and if I can make an extrapolation to our time, that the same issues are going to arise. You know, if God doesn't feel like he's there, much like the quote you read, I think, for our first lesson from C.S. Lewis, if God doesn't feel like he's there in our prayer life or in our answers to prayer, it doesn't mean he isn't still active. Mm-hmm. It just requires me to trust and believe that he has the end worked out.
It was fairly recently that I put together three ways in which the Old Testament differs from the New, and I found this very interesting to then place this in the questions that we are dealing with this quarter. In the first place, the Old Testament, there are many ways in which God is, there is a spatial separation. Mount Sinai, don't get too close to the mountain. Otherwise, you know, even a dog gets too close, he shall be stoned. And the sanctuary, we'll come to this, depicts separation. You have the most holy, the holy in the courtyard. And then you have fear. Fear is a direct
motivator.
Yeah, it is a direct motivator. And I remember Malcolm Maxwell, with the Maxwellian God, who is always gentle and kind, I would hear him describe the God of Sinai, and he would play on the Hebrew there that, you know, that you don't have, it's all indicative. So you say, you won't kill, you won't steal, and so on. And when he would get through talking about that, you could almost hear the melodious voice of God floating down the canyons at Mount Sinai, and I would say, Malcolm, that's not the way the Old Testament presents it. These people were scared to death. And in Deuteronomy 5, God says, that's good. If only you could be that way always, then you would live long. See, and so that's really quite a different one. Malcolm would simply laugh and go on with the same story. It made no difference on him. But there is that sense of separation, a sense of fear. And I'm wondering how that is reflected then, if you have that from the Old Testament, is that ever fully overcome in the New Testament? Is it overcome in the book of Revelation?
obviously, with the Gospels, Jesus comes close. The goal when God says in Exodus, is it 25, let them build me a sanctuary that I might dwell among them. He wants to be close, but there's that distance needed because of sin of people. Jesus comes fulfilling the words of Malachi, right, that says, I will come suddenly to my temple, that presence of God with the people, and Jesus arrives. And he's not what they expect. But Revelation shows at the very end of the book a picture of the temple of God with man, except there's no more structure to the sanctuary. The whole thing is built like a most holy place where God and his people are one. And so that separation
is... There was no temple there.
There was no temple there. It's just a single most holy place where God and people are together. In fact, if I might go so far as to say the imagery of the most holy place, of the holy city, appears to be that of the people of God, with God in the center of them. And that's a beautiful picture, but it's not self-obvious at first reading.
Right, yeah. Now, there's another verse in the book of Revelation which is intriguing. The opening of the ark in heaven, Revelation 11 and 19. Where does this fit in? Does that symbolize an access to heaven that we hadn't seen before?
Is the story of the cross, is it part of that, where you have the veil split in two and you have an opening and a view into the most holy place? But I also want to mention that while Revelation is picturing that end, beautiful imagery of the temple, which is open and accessible to everyone, doesn't the prophet Isaiah have a similar idea about that same kind of presence of God where everybody's part of it and lives together in harmony?
So you don't want to create too much of a tension, or you would suggest there's a little bit less separation if we read the whole Old Testament?
I think the author of Revelation takes his cues from a lot of apocalyptic literature in the Old Testament, including Isaiah and so on.
Those messianic hopes of Israel. Yeah.
Yes. I have one more practical question. This comes from the Adventist experience. Many young Adventists report a terrifying and recurring dream that when Jesus comes, their feet are glued to the ground and they can't go with him. I don't know whether that's ever happened to you, but I know that at least in my generation, this dream of Jesus coming and they can't get away from earth. So that doesn't ring bells with you, Brian.
Not at all. I've never dreamed it, and I've not heard of students who talk about it that way.
Matilda?
I only saw the clouds and I looked up.
Very good. Well, next lesson we're going to be dealing with salvation in the end time, and this is going to be another intriguing one. My conversation partners will again be Matilda and Brant. My thanks to Jared Miller, our program engineer, to all of you for listening in for the good word. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.